Hey, welcome back, everybody, to another edition of the Security Ledger Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Roberts, and I am the host, editor-in-chief of Security Ledger. And we're in the studio today with Dennis Kangooka, who is, well, one of the most renowned experts on automobile cybersecurity. And that's a topic that we've talked about and written about a lot, and a topic that's very much in the news these days. So, Dennis, welcome to Security Ledger Podcast.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's a pleasure being here.
So, before we get going, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and how you came to the auto cyber problem.
Sure. Thank you. Hi, everyone. My name is Dennis Kangooka. I'm a senior principal automotive security strategist at Synopsys. I work globally with automotive customers, such as OEMs and tier ones and tier twos, all over the world, assist them on various security strategy topics. For example, how to establish a secure software development lifecycle, how to establish security processes and practices within the organization. I've always been interested in cybersecurity. As I was growing up, I was interested in security. At the university, I took all the classes on security-related courses, software security, network security, operating system security, embedded security, cryptography, and so on. And then I, you know, had opportunity to start in automotive security. So that's really been my background now for the past 15 plus years, almost two decades now.
And like you said, you work for Synopsys. I mean, a lot of us are familiar with, Synopsys is an amazingly well-known company, and we think about them often around security, around silicon, but also embedded devices, but also like, what type of work does Synopsys do specifically around auto cyber?
So especially for the software integrity group within Synopsys, we work with a number of different organizations to help them build more high-quality, secure software faster. So we provide a set of tools, a comprehensive set of application security testing tools and services. And especially for the automotive industry, we have tools that are very strong in, for example, C and C++, covering various coding rules such as MISRA and AUTOSAR. So we have a very strong focus on the automotive industry. I also have tools that are certified to ISO 26262. So tools that can be used for development of safety critical systems, which again, you have in the automotive industry.
So, I mean, you've been doing this for a number of years, and in some ways you've really seen or witnessed the birth of auto cybersecurity or cybersecurity in the context of automotive from 20 years ago, kind of nobody was really talking about this as a thing. These days, it's very much a thing. How have you seen the like conversation evolve both within like the InfoSec community and then also on the manufacturer side?
Yes. So like you mentioned, like when I started with automotive security, there's not much going on in that whole field. So coming from a more general security background, I had opportunity to look into automotive security. This is back in 2006 at Volvo Car Corporation in Sweden. So I was one of the first people there to do some research on automotive security, especially looking at remote diagnostics and secure software updates over there. And then doing further research on secure in-vehicle communication and so on. But as I did that work and went out to present at different conferences or talk to different companies, I realized there was not much activity in this area at that point. It was a very interesting area, coming from more traditional, network security operating system, software security, looking into the embedded and automotive security and realizing there's so many things that we can do. We can learn from these other industries and we can improve security in the automotive industry as well. We just need to have the awareness in the industry to realize that we need cybersecurity, because in the early days, the most common comment was that, why do we need security? We have cars already, they're working as they should. There's no need to have any security. So that was the big challenge, I would say, for the industry to start realizing the need for cybersecurity. And I think that took many years, and it took many of us who are passionate about cybersecurity to try to change the automotive industry,
right?
By again, trying to show what can happen if you don't protect your car in a proper way.
if you were to characterize where the auto industry is right now, the manufacturers and their suppliers, with regard to this question of cybersecurity and, you know, how prominent an issue it is and how big of an area of investment it is for them, where do you think we are? Are we still, are we, you know, sort of look at like the crawl, walk, run stage, like where are we in that evolutionary stage?
So it's a really interesting question, because as we see the automotive industry apply more cybersecurity solutions into their vehicles or the, you know, entire ecosystem, at the same time, vehicles are also evolving. So you would have different types of vehicles now than you had 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So the a good way to look at it is, how fast is cybersecurity kind of following the regular development or advancement of vehicles? So if we look a little bit about into history, we saw the early days more focusing on, say, traditional security for the vehicles, not perhaps cybersecurity, but security in the sense of making sure your vehicle is locked properly and you have your immobilizer and you can prevent car theft. So those type of solutions came as we saw more vehicles being stolen, for example. So in the early, say, 2000s, we saw a rise of more use of immobilizers using cryptographic functions and so on to prevent vehicle theft. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of like the start of not cybersecurity per se, but more security solutions being applied in the vehicle industry. And then you had more research and consortia in the automotive industry where they looked at secure hardware. So for example, in 2009, you had the secure hardware extension specification released that provided a lot of the features to enable security solutions in your car with using cryptography. Mm-hmm. So that again was another way to improve the security posture in the industry, as well as allow new security solutions to be deployed. And then that continued on to early 2010s, with you have more security solutions in your vehicle. And then you also had the big presentations at Black Hat and DEF CON by Charlie Miller. And I think that also helped grow the awareness in the industry that this is possible. You can perform these type of attacks on vehicles, and the impact can be huge as well. So I think that was another level in the industry where we had initial car thefts being one activity to happen. We came up with new solutions for that. We had these attacks shown by Miller and Valasek, and now we have to come up with new solutions to prevent that. Mm. So I think we've always seen this evolution of new solutions coming in. And nowadays, when we move towards more software-defined vehicles, we have this whole mobility ecosystem. So we go beyond the car itself to back-end solutions, mobile apps. And that means we also need to protect those parts of the ecosystem. So I think that that's how we see that secure solutions are constantly evolving in the industry. But the scope of protection is also evolving. As mentioned initially, maybe it's just one ECU for your immobilizer. Mm-hmm. And then it grew to maybe your external facing ECUs, like your telematics unit. And now you have the ecosystem, you have your backend solutions and your mobile apps. So you have more and more systems and assets you have to protect, as well as new solutions you have to apply to that. So that's the evolution I see right now happening.
I mean, I remember like with Miller and Valasek, which obviously, you know, as a cybersecurity reporter got my attention and many others. One of the interesting things that I recall is that, you know, before the Jeep Cherokee hack, which I think was 2015, they had done a similar type of attack, but using the OBD2 port, I think it was a Prius or something like that. You know, and they were able to control it and control braking and steering and stuff like that. And as I recall, the reaction from the industry was kind of a big shrug, like, well, I mean, yeah, but they're in the passenger compartment and they have access to the port, you know, we do two ports. So, I mean, you know, practically this isn't that big of a deal. But at the time, of course, all these automakers were either rolling out or about to roll out vehicles with cellular data connections, right? And to me, it sort of struck me like, well, aren't they putting two and two together and being like, well, okay, there's a software-based attack that has control over, you know, cyber-physical systems, like actual kinetic systems on the device. And, oh yeah, we're adding this like always-on internet connection. So actually you could, like once that happens, and you could get, you know, and like I mean, was that conversation happening within the car companies, like way back, you know, pre Jeep Cherokee, to be like, oh yeah, like we got to really rethink our whole approach to security because our risk posture just really is changing as we're adding these connectivity features? Or was it more kind of, as we see so often, you know, the hack begets a reaction and then there's a lot of bolt-on fixes and stuff like that, but there isn't this sort of anticipation?
Yes. So there's actually a couple of research papers in 2010 and 2011 that also showed the same type of attacks, right? So you had wire type of attacks over OB2 or directly to the CAN bus, as well as wireless attacks. And I think that it showed technically what's feasible, but for the automotive industry, as you know, there's always this risk level
calculation,
to see how easy it is to perform such an attack and how large the impact could be. So initially, you know, there was not too much attention about these attacks in 2010 and 11, but it's more when it hit mainstream media in 2013, as you mentioned, with the Prius attack, and 2015 with the Jeep attack, where more people, you know, were aware of this type of attack.
It's in Wired. And, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then suddenly you also have thousands of other people looking into this and trying to learn how to hack these cars. So you have many more people getting into learning, understanding what are, you know, weaknesses in vehicles, how can you exploit them. So now you have much more attention than you used to have.
Car hacking that, village at DEF CON.
Yes.
Right, and, right. Yeah. Yep.
Exactly. So now you have all these new car hacking villages. You have all the security people moving into looking at automotive. And I think that's partly where you see the, you know, automotive industry change their view of this as well, where in the early days, as you said, like in 2013, basically that's how the vehicles function, right? So there's not a security issue. If you send a command to, you know, to tell the ECU to do something, the ECU is going to do that. So it's kind of like the early days with Telnet. You know, there's no encrypted communication. It's all in plain text, but that's not really a security weakness in that, say, or like vulnerability, because that's how the protocol is designed.
Yeah.
And very similar to the CAN bus.
Pretty much all of the core internet protocols were sort of pre-security, right? It's like, let's just get everyone talking to everyone. And then like, yeah, you know, the security stuff, like that'll come after.
Exactly. So I think that's part of the thought process, where the vehicle has its, you know, internal in-vehicle network. It's isolated. There's no, you know, security in that sense, because you have trusted ECUs or nodes on that network. And if you connect something to that network directly, like you did in 2013, and you send messages, of course, the ECUs are going to respond, because that's how it's designed. So I think that was part of the response from the industry, that yes, that's going to happen. If you connect something and send a correct message, that's going to happen. But I think in 2015, where Belasek and Miller really showed that, well, we can do this remotely. And that really changed the attitude from in industry, because yes, if you connect something directly, that's going to happen. But remotely, and bypassing all these security measures that you would typically have in place, that really showed that we have to do something better. We have to protect our vehicles. That's where we saw a lot of investment happening, both in organizations to establish cybersecurity teams, change their development processes. We also saw the birth of cybersecurity standards in the automotive industry. So 2016, I think, was the first release of the SAJ 3061, which was more of a, you know, I guess the first cybersecurity standard for automotive. And that was then replaced or superseded by the ISO 21434. But it also showed that the industry was very serious about cybersecurity and started forming these groups, creating standards, thinking about how do we improve the security posture in the industry.
So these days, when you think about or you read about auto cyber, a lot of what you're seeing is car theft stories, right? You know, CAN bus injection attacks, where they're kind of, you know, get the thieves on video kind of up under the wheel well, and they're finding the ECU there and basically unlocking the doors and starting the car without a key and then stealing it. Is that sort of where the rubber meets the road? Pun intended, on auto cyber right now? Or is that sort of like, okay, yeah, but that's a fixable problem. There are bigger problems to deal with.
So you're right. I think we see those type of attacks, and that kind of goes back to the early days, as I mentioned, with, you know, when you started getting better solutions for immobilizer and so on, that a lot of these new solutions are driven by, for example, car theft or attacks that happen that cause some financial damage or brand damage. So that's where we see the introduction of, for example, at the time, you know, these immobilizers using cryptographic functions and so on. And now, as you see, we have those relay type of attacks with the key fobs and, as you mentioned,
amplifier, just, kind of amplifying the key.
Exactly. Or like you say, just directly plugging into the CAN bus and then, you know, unlocking the vehicle. So those type of attacks have a direct financial damage on vehicle owners and the OEMs as well. Brand damage for the OEMs, showing that those type of attacks are possible. And those are very, say, practical attacks because they can happen, can be, you know, performed by organized groups and so on.
Yep.
And we also have the other, you know, type of attacks, which are more of these research related attacks, right? Where we look at the new attack vectors. So you have the V2X, for example, the vehicle to X communication. So finding new vulnerabilities in that type of communication. We also look at the EVs. So looking at the charging stations, electric vehicles.
As a vector for malicious software, for example.
Yes, exactly. So that's another type of attack vector where either you can try to attack the vehicle directly, you can attack the charging station, you can trick the charging station so that you can basically charge your vehicle for free. So again, a lot of financial incentives are driving these type of attacks. And as you mentioned, like we have the CAN-based attacks where you need physical access. I think we will always have some of those attacks because vehicles are out there in the world. People can physically walk up to a vehicle, unplug, or you know, take out the headlamp and try to plug into the CAN bus. So there's always going to be a physical threat to vehicles. But we'll also see more of these wireless type of attacks, as mentioned, with the keyless entry, V2X. We'll have the, again, physical type of attacks with the EVs and the charging stations. So I see the attack surface growing as we have more features in vehicles. And, you know, it's going to, you have more improved user experience by adding these features. At the same time, you also have new attack surfaces that you need to, think about when you design.
As with every other product. Right.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, I mean, some of these technologies like the CAN bus technology are quite old. They were, you know, pre-internet and were not really designed with security in mind. They were really about response time and availability and were the priorities. Are automakers looking to replace those with, you know, newer protocols and kind of core systems and technologies that are better adapted for, you know, the modern threat environment and kind of discontinue some of those legacy protocols and technologies? Is that something that's going on right now?
We see different types of security approaches being taken in an industry now. So as you mentioned with the CAN bus, typically in the early days of designing CAN bus and the EE architecture, you would have pretty much a flat architecture so that if you connect to the CAN bus, you have access to any other ECU on that network. So we see changes now in having more isolation. You have some kind of secure design of the architecture so that if an attacker is able to compromise one ECU, they're only able to compromise or be able to access other ECUs on that same domain or on that network so that you can limit some of the damage and then you have another security hurdle that you have to bypass to get to the next level. So those are types of approaches we're seeing. We also see, as you mentioned, improvements to the CAN protocol. We already had in AutoSAR, for example, the definition or the specification for SecOC, secure onboard communication. So now you can have authenticated communication on the CAN bus. So that allows you to verify messages are authentic, they haven't been, you know, modified, and they come from the right sender. We also see a shift towards using automotive Ethernet, where you, again, can have more security solutions, for example, using MACsec or TLS. So we have more security protocols or security solutions that we can run on these protocols. But as you mentioned before, too, we have some of these legacy protocols in the vehicle because there's still a cost versus risk calculation that's being performed by car manufacturers. So we can see changes into the EE architecture. A lot of these platforms are built for many years. So it's not going to be easy to replace everything at once. So we'll probably see like a gradual upgrade of certain protocols being replaced. But you'll still have some features running on simpler protocols because that's all they need. And you may have more of the important communication performed over more secure protocols or networks.
What's really interesting to me is automakers have always had among the longest and most complex supply chains, right, of components for these vehicles. So, I mean, supply chain management and security around, you know, integrity and identifying counterfeits and stuff like that. I mean, automakers have always been the forefront of that. But as you know, increasingly software, you know, the supply chain conversation is these days often about software supply chain, you know, open source, third party code, you know, internal first party proprietary code, and kind of where risks can work their way into. Do you see that conversation happening within the automotive space as well? So, you know, they're very sophisticated on the vehicle supply chain, but are they as attuned to software supply chain risk?
So, yes, so that's a really good point. And we see that's happening now in the past few years where software security supply chain has become a really big topic. And as you mentioned, you have, again, you know, looking at software-defined vehicles, for example, you have larger software code bases coming from multiple sources. You have your in-house development, you have your third-party supplier code, open source software. You have auto-generated code from various tools. And now lately as well, you have AI generated code as well that you have to consider. So you have all of the different types of code, right? And now you need to understand, how can that piece of software affect my system that I'm designing or developing?
Right.
And attackers can see this as well, that it might be hard for me to directly attack a certain software or hardware, ECU for a vehicle. But if I can maybe target a software supplier and inject some malicious code there, sure, then that's going to get included in the whole chain of, you know, suppliers, yeah, and finally ended up in a vehicle. Could be a backdoor, could be whatever it is. So that approach of, you know, taking by attackers is also changing, which is why the industry has to look at not only protecting my code that I'm developing, but every piece of software I receive from any supplier, I need to verify that that also doesn't contain any malicious code or doesn't contain any additional weaknesses or vulnerabilities.
Sure. It's a SolarWinds, you know, yeah, story, but across the whole economy, right? I mean, it's not just automotive that has this, it needs to have be having this conversation and looking at, you know, SolarWinds or 3CX or whatever, you know, as a cautionary tale, I guess.
Exactly. And maybe just to add to that is the added functionality now with software updates over the air. Mm-hmm. So it's not only during the development of the vehicle that you have to make sure that software is included in a proper way, but now you have features that allows you to update your software after release as well. And that's another huge attack vector where attackers could potentially inject their code into that software update. So again, we have to look at, how do we protect this whole vehicle's ecosystem? You have even some infotainment systems that allow you to download third-party apps and plugins, yeah, and things like that. That could be another attack vector. So it might be outside of the original control of the OEM. And now you have these new attack vectors again that you have to look at when you want to protect your vehicle.
I mean, I've definitely talked to threat researchers and stuff who will sort of say, like, listen, you know, it's only a matter of time with just the explosion of the Internet of Things and, you know, connected everything, that ransomware groups clue into the fact that, like, well, we've got this B2B model, but, like, let's go B2C, you know, let's start putting ransomware on refrigerators and automobiles in people's driveways. Like, that'll really, you know, it's a much bigger sea of, you know, potential victims that we can attack. Do you think the manufacturers see that as a potential risk and are prepared for that? Or is it going to once again fall to the bad guys to lead by example, and then everybody will just react and respond to it?
So I think that's also a very interesting topic. So ransomware vehicles, there was some research done a few years ago where they showed, for example, your infotainment system could get infected by ransomware. So when you are about to you know, take your car and drive off, there might be a screen on your infotainment system or a message on your infotainment system saying that, you know, your car has been locked and you have to pay this much to unlock your vehicle. From the auto manufacturer's point of view, I think what's important to understand is, how do you prevent such attacks from happening on a large scale? So if a ransomware occurs, you want to make sure that it's at least isolated as much as possible, so that if one vehicle is infected, another vehicle cannot be infected very easily. Because if you have this happening to millions of vehicles, that can cause a huge damage. But if it takes a lot of effort from one, you know, or a team of cyber attackers to create this ransomware for one vehicle, and it's going to take the same amount to do it for a second vehicle, then at least you have some design and some solutions that can prevent this from scaling easily. So I think that's one way of looking at, we can't prevent 100% of these type of attacks. We can make it harder for attackers to perform these type of attacks on a large scale. So I think that's the main point. Another part is making sure that when you do your initial threat analysis and risk assessment, make sure that you consider those type of threats. Ransomware is a threat. How do you design your systems? Maybe you have some additional countermeasures. If you detect something like this, can you somehow go into a fail secure state and still allow certain critical features of the vehicle to work? Maybe everything won't work, but at least you can maybe drive your vehicle and, you know, take it to a safe location. So things of that, like how do you have some kind of safe state where the vehicle can revert to in case there is a cyber attack on the vehicle?
Right. Kind of isolating the core functions of the vehicle from that type of attack. Okay, so I would be, you know me, I'm very involved in the right to repair as an issue. One of the issues, questions that often comes up with the right to repair in the context of automotive is cybersecurity. Automakers have kind of suggested that, you know, opening up vehicle telematic systems to independent repair car owners would pose a cybersecurity risk that, you know, it can't be done securely. And so we need to be the ones who control that. This is a bigger question. This goes beyond automobiles to really this notion of reuse and circular economy, you know, that we need to be able to repair and fix and maintain our stuff. Manufacturers often, not automobiles so much, but other types of manufacturers often just walk away from their products. You know, they stop maintaining them and doing security updates. And so the owners are kind of left in the lurch, like, well, how do I keep this thing running? And that is potentially an issue that could affect vehicles down the road as well. What are your thoughts? Are these two things, you know, repairability, maintainability, in tension with cybersecurity, or can you have both? Can you have both cyber secure and more or less open in terms of maintenance and repair and stuff like that?
So that's a very good question. I would say a number of different areas or things that you need to consider for this type of solution. So on the one hand, having or providing the data required to perform repairs. I think that would be something that third-party repair shops and so on could have access to, right? Because then they can perform the repairs they need to do. The challenge is, how do you provide that data? Because the OEMs are typically collecting that data, and you need to make sure that you provide that data to the right dealer at the right time, the right type of data.
And in some kind of time limited, right? It's not a permanent open door. It's, you know, you have this
exactly
window, right? Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's where I see some of the challenges of, how can I make sure that if my repair shop can only have access to my data for 24 hours, for example, and this type of data to perform this type of repair, I don't want them to access other types of data from my vehicle. Maybe there's some privacy related topics there. And also, I don't want them to access the data after. So can I revoke the access somehow, or make sure that they can't keep accessing my data?
Right.
That whole system of making sure that as a user, I can feel comfortable that my data is only accessed by someone that I give permission to for a certain amount of time, for example, and certain type of data. And from an attacker's point of view, that system that will provide all of this access to data is going to be a very lucrative target as well, because maybe I can pose as a, you know, third-party repair shop and say, I need access to these vehicles and I can get all the data. How do I authenticate that I'm an authorized dealer? Or maybe there's even weaknesses in that communication protocol, that the vehicle portal, whatever they need to build. Who is responsible for ensuring security for that portal? And maybe I can perform some injection attacks there and extract all the data from the database. So those are the type of security threats that would exist.
So those threats exist with the OEM systems. I mean, that's kind of what Sam Curry was showing you. Like those threats are there with the OEM system as well. Are there vehicle makers, not consumer, but commercial? I mean, are there examples of that kind of open? I mean, I know we have it with, you know, the physical access, the OBD2 port, like that already is a thing, right? Independent repair shops can plug in under the dashboard and get all that data. But when we look at it like wirelessly and the more modern telematics system, are there examples of systems like that are both you know, secure, but also open to third parties and non, you know, non-dealers, non-authorized, or, you know, owners and independents as well. Are there examples of that that we know of?
So I've only seen in the past when they, like OEMs, would release a aftermarket version of their diagnostics tools that you plug in, you know, over OBD2 port. You would have maybe some limited functionality, so you can't perform all the things that an OEM can do, but you can still access some of the data and you can perform some of the diagnostics, the function tests, and, you know, reprogramming and so on.
Things you need to do to complete repairs, right?
Yes, exactly. But I think there's still some features, security related features that OEMs want to keep to themselves. It could be related to, you know, intellectual property or, you know, secure algorithms and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there may be some features that you would have to take it to an, you know, official OEM dealer to have fixed. And I think with the telematics data, that's the challenge of how do you separate something that is a non-security related data that, you know, you can provide to third-party repair shops, and what is security related data that the OEM should have access to only and make sure that, you know, it's protected.
Is that data separate now, or is it all basically in the same stream?
So typically now it is should be separated in a way, and especially for the OEM to make sure that some of those security features are only accessible by authorized dealers. So I think that that's where the challenge is of how do you make sure that you can provide, especially now when you collect so much more data from vehicles, how can you still provide some of that data to all of these different dealers in a secure manner? Again, you need to have that platform set up. You need to have different authorization access to certain types of data, to certain dealers and so on. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's really where we are on how do we make sure that we can do that in a proper, secure way to avoid any potential, you know, security incidents from happening.
Dennis, is there anything that I didn't ask you that you wanted to say?
One thing I did that briefly mentioned before that I also think it's becoming, you know, very relevant nowadays is the AI topic. So we do see a lot more focus on AI in the automotive industry. So AI being used for development, code generation, as I mentioned before. And we have the big challenge of using AI for code generation is, for example, the code that's being generated, you can't assume that it's safe and secure code that's being automatically generated from your tool. There might be vulnerabilities or weaknesses in that code. So it can create a false sense of security that if I just ask AI to write my code, I'll get a perfect code. So that's one thing where we're trying to make sure that we have to still be careful with the code that's being generated by AI systems. We still have to do our testing of that code, scanning it, finding weaknesses, vulnerabilities as any type of software that you write. There might also be license compliance problems because that code could have been trained on open source software projects.
Yes.
And now you
yes.
generate code that's actually using that open source software project and you have that license tied to that as well. So we're really trying to make sure that AI has a lot of benefits, but you also have to consider the challenges that are still there with AI. But definitely we see also new solutions with AI for, you know, developing more secure software with, for example, providing more information to the developer, how to fix a problem, how to do some auto triage and auto fix issues, automated testing. So definitely a lot of benefits in using AI, but also being cautious of the results that you get from AI systems.
Its knowledge of code is based on code written by human beings. So, you know, buyer beware.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And we all know human beings are fallible. yeah. Dennis Kengo-Oka, Senior Principal Automotive Security Strategist at Synopsys. Thank you so much for coming in and speaking to us on Security Ledger Podcast. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's been a pleasure being here. Really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll do it again.